Now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Kick him 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 out the door.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. This program is podcast. You'll be able to access the podcast, like hundreds of others, on 3cr.org.au, Radical Australia. Now, Henrietta once again is doing all the hard work, pressing the buttons. Once again, she refuses to be identified as part of this program. She's ashamed of what's been on the program. But, however, she said a word. Did you hear that? She said, however. Did you hear that? She's real. She's not AI or an avatar. But we have a very special guest, another ornament on the 3CR Christmas tree. We have Di Cousins, C-O-U-S-E-N-S, from Spoken Word. Hello, Di.
Hello, Joe. Great to be here.
That's what they all say, Di, at the beginning of the interview. Now, would you like to start off with reading us one of your poems, as you're
sure.
from Spoken Word?
Yeah. So this is from my most recent collection, which is called One Breath. And it's a haibun, a Japanese form. After detention offshore. We were walking up and down the street, looking for help wanted notices. I asked him about being homeless. Was he cold at night? He said he was fine. He had two blankets. What about a sleeping bag? I asked. What is that? He asked. I guess they don't have them in Iran. I described it as like two blankets stitched together. Yes, they had given him one at the Salvation Army office in the city, but he didn't think it was useful because it would bind his feet when people come to attack him in the night. I agreed I had not thought of that. And this is the haiku. A windy season. A branch fell last night. Morning. And the tree still shakes.
Now, can I ask you a simple question? What is a haiku?
Okay, so haiku, let's just say it has three lines, two images, maybe a seasonal reference.
Right. You said it's a Japanese construct, is it?
Yeah, Japanese form.
Mm. And what's its history?
Well, it was made famous by the poet Basho in, I think, the 17th century, which was where he went on a lot of tours around Japan and wrote little descriptive passages and then the little haiku kind of summarising his feelings intermittently in the text. Mm. And then it became popularised by many others. I'm currently reading a book of haiku by a poet called Issa, I-double-S-A, who I've never read before, and he's got amazing haiku. He's from, the 19th century.
Now, I said you were from Spoken Word.
Yes.
What is that? Is that a 3CR program?
Yes, it is, as you know.
As I know.
I think you were our grandfather, weren't you, Joe?
Great-grandfather.
So you can tell me, how did it happen?
Well, 25 years ago, we started Talk Back with Attitude. As you know, poets like to be heard. And we get inundated by poets, and they take up half of the one-hour show. So I said to them, and I forget who my co-host was in those days, I said to them, look, if you make an application for your own show, We will give you the spot from 9 to 10 and we'll take the spot from 10 to 11 because we're too lazy to come in at 9 o'clock to do Talk Back with Attitude. And who took it up? You know who took it up? Your founder.
Rhonda Jankovic.
Yes, Rhonda Jankovic, an extraordinary human being. Unfortunately, Rhonda, within about 6 months of starting the spoken word program, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and died soon after. It was just a great tragedy here at 3CR.
Yeah, great loss.
Yeah, but the funny thing about spoken word is about 10 years later, you know, we used to come after spoken word and we'd make a few jokes about spoken word, you know, and they lodged an official complaint against us at 3CR and we had to stop mentioning them. It was horrendous. They denied their origins.
Well, the past, the history has been rectified now. So
oh, thank
it's okay.
you. So what year were you born?
Well, in the early 60s.
Early 60s. I like that. The early 60s. Obviously, yeah. You're going to be such a popular interview that you don't want people to hassle you. So you don't want to give them your exact year because then they'll find you on the net. Is that correct?
Well, no, it's just because these days birth date information has become one of those intellectual properties that is a problem. So,
that's right.
Yeah, I'm not actually embarrassed about my age.
No,
but,
no.
But anyway, I could have grandchildren potentially, but I don't.
You don't. All right. Now, 1960s were your formative years.
That's right.
Are your parents still with us?
No, they died a long time ago.
And what were their names?
I was Angela and Timothy.
And what were they like as parents?
Well, they were very creative and kind of... Dad used to be a radio broadcaster at Radio Australia, which in, back in the day was a shortwave service of the ABC. And it was one of the best ways for the people of... you know, the Pacific and Southeast Asia to access information. Malcolm Turnbull turned it into an internet service when he was the Prime Minister some other minister.
And then the Chinese took the...
And then the Chinese took over the shortwave bands, which was a great loss because actually that service was free and accessible, whereas an internet service is not free, not necessarily accessible. But anyway, so he was a creative person. He started in radio back in the late 40s after coming over to Australia as an English immigrant. He'd been here previously on a Navy ship as part of the British Navy. And he came back and then he was shifted to Melbourne by the ABC and then he ended up working for Radio Australia for 35 years. And but he was a very creative person. He liked to do pottery and painting and all kinds of things, photography. We had a dark room downstairs in the house. And so I learnt a little bit about how to do black and white printing in the dark room. And you know how to use a black and white film camera and those kinds of things, which I only gave up about 20 years ago.
Mm, I won't ask you why. Was it hard getting somebody else to buy the film? I assume 20 years.
Well, it's getting harder to get it printed anyway.
Yeah, it is getting harder. My late wife used to do part of her artistic talents were a photographer. She's got a number of photographs in some of the major institutions. And she had this special place where she'd go to print these huge black and white photographs, but I think they folded.
Yeah. It's a shame.
It is a shame.
I mean, the qualities.
Dark and white photos can tell you so much.
Yeah, and there's a difference in quality between a print from film and a print from digital. But anyway, it's very, very handy being able to see how photos look, in real life, real time.
I'm going to ask you a rude question. Was your father employed because he had the perfect English accent for the ABC?
Absolutely, yes.
We forget, don't we, that you couldn't speak Australiana on the ABC till the 70s.
That's right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. It was required. Yeah, everybody had an English accent.
Yeah. How about your mum? What?
Yeah, well, my mother was an interesting person. Her mother was Canadian and, you know, those grandparents met in like 1910 or something. And then they married in the middle of the First World War in London. And as a Canadian person, she had different kinds of interests when she moved out to Australia. So she was a very good cook, mm-hmm. With a fairly international cuisine. And she used to write for magazines about all kinds of things. She was a journalist, and she would write about current affairs, you know, travel, art, cooking. I mean, just about everything. Mm. But she was a fairly strong character. She wasn't kind of easy to get along with.
A lot of daughters say that, don't they? Yes. Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have an older brother.
And was he easy to get along with?
No.
No. Remember, we can be sued, so don't say anything rude.
It's sad.
That's the way it goes with families. We've all got one in the closet.
That's right.
Yeah, anyway, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, it's always. So, where did you go to primary school?
I went to a really lovely, very creative school called Christchurch Grammar in South Yarra.
Right.
And then, and that was really great. And they would always tell you, you can be anything, you can do anything. And they gave you the opportunity to be and do anything. And it was really fun. And after that, I went to a very strict girls' school called Merton Hall, where they were very, had a lot of rules. And then I got
Hang on. Was this the late 70s or
yes,
early 80s?
Late 70s.
I mean, it wasn't a time for rules. I mean, high schools or secondary college were very unruly in those days.
Well, girls' school was very strict.
Very strict.
Yeah.
Did you wear a Panama hat?
I don't know, but I did wear a hat.
Right.
Anyway, I
wasn't
can't
a
remember
straw
now.
Hat, a Panama
yeah, I think
hat.
We had a straw hat. Yeah, we had a straw hat.
We used to laugh at those kids that used to go to private schools who had a Panama hat.
Yeah.
And did you have the coat? And the...
We had a lot of things, gloves and, you know, God knows. Anyway.
Henrietta's nodding. I assume she went to a private girl school too.
Yes. Anyway.
You survived.
I survived at the end of what we now call year 11. I went to Taylor's College just for the freedom and liberation, you know, just to be back in a more unstructured atmosphere.
What, you rebelled?
Yeah.
And what did your parents think of this little rebellion?
I mean, it wasn't a popular move, but I think it was good for me.
Was Taylor's College one of those preparatory colleges where you did shorthand and all that type of stuff?
Or? It had a business college side, but it also had a generic a high school side, and it had good teachers. Like one of my teachers for classical civilization, which is the study of Greece and Rome and archaeology and all these kinds of things, was Homer Reith, who right. is a well-known Melbourne poet, died about 5 years ago. And, you know, and others who were really in love with their work, you know, were in love with the things that they were teaching. They were really motivated and good to study with. So it was nice to, you know, have a really positive experience of education.
Right. And did that lead to higher education?
Yeah. So then I went on and I went to RMIT, but I didn't – I at that stage I'd had enough of being at school and I dropped out after half a year. But
What were you doing that was so interesting? What course were you doing?
I was doing journalism.
Journalism. Congratulations that you dropped out. You wouldn't have a job these days.
I know. It's a bit hard, isn't it?
It's very harsh.
Poor old journos.
Very harsh. Now, I understand a little sparrows told me that you started radio as a young person.
Yeah, that's right. So my dad got me into Radio Australia.
Nepotism.
I know. Back in the day.
We didn't know what the word meant.
Yeah. Just to come in, we had Radio Australia had a program called Countdown, which broadcast Australian music and other music all over Southeast Asia, as Radio Australia did, and I'd come in and provide a sort of a segment of news about bands. And I was very into the music scene at the time and used to go to concerts all the time. And I was a great enthusiast for music.
Did you go to pub concerts?
No, yeah, absolutely.
So, beer soap carpet.
And Festival Hall. Oh, yes. And, you know, Status Quo and yeah. AC/DC and, you know, Dragon and Skyhooks and, sorry? Yeah, you know, and the bands at Crystal Ballroom.
Would you like to put on your microphone, Henrietta? I mean, we can't hear you. I mean, we know you're a musician and a music lover.
So Henrietta just said the boys next door. Yeah. So, yes, and every other band that, you know, because, you know, punk came along, new wave came along, all kinds of great things happened. It was an exciting time.
Did you just sit in a chair and, or did you just jump up and down at, on the microphone?
Yeah, it was a great – no, I was just somebody – I'd just jump up and down and dance and have fun. It was a great time.
On a microphone. No. Unlike today.
Not like a microphone – not with a microphone. No, no, just a member of the audience.
A member of the audience. But I'm just saying when you – with your dad on Radio Australia.
Oh, on Radio Australia, I just – no, well, it wasn't with Dad. He didn't do the countdown program. It was a woman who was also a ballet teacher. No, well, there I was just sitting and reporting on what the current news was regarding, you know, what bands were doing.
Yeah. Did this radicalise you as a youngster?
Well, I think I think I was always questioning of authority and, you know, very committed to things being reasonable.
Reasonable?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, like, you know, not having rules just for the sake of having rules, but just, you know, giving people opportunities to do what they want to do rather than just imposing a lot of arbitrary rules that don't have any purpose.
You sound like a nihilist. A young nihilist. A rebel without a cause.
Anyway.
Or did you have a cause in those days?
I don't know. I mean, I think there were lots of causes around at the time. I remember going to demonstrations, you know, for international things like, and I don't know, remember exactly some of them, but things like...
nuclear disarmament?
Yeah, nuclear disarmament and...
Palm Sunday rallies.
Yeah, you know, like there was something to do with Nicaragua and the Sandinistas.
Yes.
You know, there was all kinds of things.
And you got involved in that.
Well, I'd happy to turn up.
You made up the numbers. You weren't part of a telephone box minority. You tried to make it into a mass movement. So you told us you dropped out of journalism.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, then I got involved at the St Martin's Youth Art Centre.
Excuse me? St Martin's Youth Art Centre?
Yes, which was in South Yarra, and it was theatre for young people, disaffected young people who were looking for something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did theatre. And at that time, Gina Riley and Jane Turner were there as well. Mm. So,
well, what happened to you? Don't name drop.
Anyway, they had star quality.
They had star quality. Did they have star quality then?
Well, I had no idea they had it.
In other words, they got some lucky breaks.
Well, they were very good at what they did. But they had perseverance and commitment, and I went off to India.
Excuse me?
Yeah,
I went off to India. How old were you?
Well, I was just about to turn 19.
And you went off to India? And you were born in the 60s.
Mm.
So this is what, the late 80s?
No, it's the early 80s.
Early 80s. Oh, yeah, I can't do my maths. You went off to India. What year was this?
1980.
What made you want to go to India? What was wrong with you?
Well, I was working in a shop in Brunswick Street at 175 Brunswick Street.
Uh-huh.
And we sold books and all kinds of things, and including jewellery and little Asian artefacts. And these traders used to come in from India and Nepal and everywhere, and I was in charge of buying stock. And so they would tell me about all the places they were visiting in Asia. And I had planned, you know, I was sort of planning to save up and go overseas, and I was planning to go to Europe. And I said, no, don't go to Europe, go to India and Nepal and wherever. And so I said, okay. And so that's where I went.
In 1980.
Hmm.
What, for a 3-week trip that turned out to be a year?
Yeah, no, I went for a year.
You went for a year.
I went for
a year. You wanted to go for a year. Had you made any forward plans?
No.
So what? Where did you
I started off in Penang, and then I went up through Thailand and Burma and Nepal, and then I went around India in all kinds of places, and you know, including Kashmir and Bhopal and all sorts of places. You know, Varanasi, Jaipur, Agra, and then
on your own?
Yeah.
And did you feel safe?
I did.
Right.
I did. Maybe good. I just wasn't paying attention, but I felt fine.
Well, if nothing happened to you, it was fine. And did you have to do anything to augment your income?
Well, no, because back in the day, India was very affordable.
Yeah, it was.
You know, it was incredibly cheap. Anyway, so then I came back to Australia and then I...
After a year of wandering around India, you didn't get sick?
No.
Didn't get hepatitis?
No.
Mm. You become a vegetarian, I assume, when you were there?
Actually, not at that stage.
Right.
Anyway, but then I went back to India, and then my aunt died and left me some money, and then I stayed there for 3 years.
3 years. When was that?
In the mid-80s.
So you went. So what drew you back to India?
I just had a kind of a... well, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, Australia was a very narrow kind of society. And also we were in the middle of the White Australia policy when I was growing up. And people didn't have a lot of different ideas and, you know, things were very, very narrow. And when I went to India, it was a whole world that I had no idea about. And I thought, I don't understand anything and I want to spend time here and understand what's going on, because I didn't have a clue. And it took a long time to understand India.
And what are your conclusions?
Well, I mean, you know, 20 years ago I went back and I did a PhD in India about...
In India?
In India.
Through what institution?
Monash University.
And they let you go without a supervisor?
Well, I mean, you know, I was old enough.
I mean a PhD supervisor.
I had three supervisors.
Three supervisors.
They were all, you know, either in Australia or overseas or somewhere.
Uh-huh. Did they actually do anything for you, or you just ignored them and just did your own research?
No, they were very helpful, but obviously when you do a PhD, you have to make an original contribution to knowledge. So therefore, only I actually knew what I was doing.
And what was the topic of your thesis? Oh, we need to know the topic.
The topic was the temple of Chuloknath and the self-arising statue of Chuloknath or something like that.
And I assume it's quoted in multiple papers since then?
Probably,
but you haven't checked.
Well, I don't know.
You don't know. Anyway. And it, obviously this led to some high-paying diplomatic job, did it?
No.
No. So while you're in India, a lot of people kind of get converted while they're in India. Did you have any religious or spiritual experiences that kept you there?
Yeah, that's right. I did. So at some point I decided Buddhism made sense and so I would become a Buddhist. And
could you please explain how does it make sense?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, in India there's a very big idea about a spiritual path and there are other dimensions of experience. And so I went around during some of my different trips and I visited temples and ashrams and I even went as far as the Karakoram Ranges in the north of Pakistan. And I met all kinds of people and I asked them what did they, you know, think and believe and do and what have you. And eventually when I was staying in a Christian ashram in the south of India, I met a Tibetan Lama who talked about compassion and wisdom in a way that made me think, well, he actually knows what he's talking about. So I'm going to adopt Tibetan Buddhism. That makes sense.
And have you continued in that law, in that tradition?
Yeah, 40 years on. Yeah.
40 years on. I wouldn't just... You're not a Buddhist nun, are you?
No.
You never were?
No.
No.
Never, never.
A devotee?
Yeah.
What can I say? Well, the good thing about Buddhists is occasionally they get into physical violence, as we've seen in Burma, occasionally, but usually most Buddhists are pretty peace-loving people, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. So I'm on various advisory bodies for the state government, for example. I'm on the multi-faith advisory group as a Buddhist representative. And, you know, we have to talk about world politics quite often. And I always say, well, what we would like to propose is a non-violent resolution to conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be a radical idea.
It is, isn't it? It is. It is a radical idea. Yeah, non-violent resolution to conflict. Oh, my God. You've been reading the Bible and the Quran, have you, and the Hindu scriptures. It seems that every religion wants that.
Well, anyway, I mean, like, you know, that's what we propose. We want a non-violent resolution to conflict. Mm. And
So you're a practicing Buddhist.
Yeah.
What does that mean regarding your time? Does it mean you go to a temple or how does it work?
I think it's really a point of view being a Buddhist. You just see things in a certain way. So, like, for example, we believe that things happen because of causes rather than randomly or because God decided. Mm. And so you pay attention to causes and and also consequences. So you pay attention to your interactions with other people and try not to create bad causes and consequences. Mm. So I think it's really, it's not just about quantifying, well, I sit on a cushion for half an hour every day or I recite this number of mantras. I think it's just a way of seeing the world and being in the world.
Right. Well, look, while I remind people what program they're on, maybe you could do another poem for us.
Yes, sure.
I'm chatting with Di Cousens, Cousens, if you want to look her up on the World Wide Web. And obviously we haven't even got to the poetry and spoken word yet, but we'll get there. Now, Henrietta's actually spoken during this half hour and she's been with me a few months now and I'm just shocked. So what I need to do is bring in more musicians and that will get you a... And more Buddhists. So would you like to put on your mind microphone? Nora.
Okay, so I'd like to read a poem about the Burrup Peninsula in Western Australia, which is the world's largest outdoor rock engraving site. And the rock art is up to 30,000 years old and includes what may be the first depiction of the human face. ALBO has, the federal government has approved various gas facilities and so on, which are going to put this extraordinary World Heritage classified outdoor oldest rock art in the world in danger. So this is my poem and it's called The Burrup Speaks. The stars are mine. I own the night and the morning. I feel the wind and the rain. I was not made. I have been here since the beginning. My body is in the rocks, each one. You can see my faces in the marks. Fish, emus, people, birds. That long gone stripy dog. I have so many hands, heads and feet. But roads cut me and mines consume me. I fracture and gasp, but I am still breathing. One stone of mine is all of me. Don't put my stones in a museum.
Right. Well, as they say, that's a total word picture, isn't it? You know what the big news today is? You won't believe this. You reading that reminded me of the big news today.
What's that?
They've discovered in a cave in Wales some red lines and they've calculated they're 17,500 years old and the oldest European art that's ever been found.
Oh.
Right? Look at this, 40,000 years, carved in rock, not just some red lines.
Yeah.
And we're destroying it.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is unbelievable.
I can't get my head around why they don't care. You know, the people with power, they just don't care.
There's no money to be made. Maybe if we could actually chip it and sell chips to tourists, They'd care. What do you reckon?
Well, that's what they're doing to the Barrier Reef. They carve out tons and tons of coral and ship it off all the time. And
and the fish.
I don't think that's a sign of caring.
It's not a sign of caring? No. Maybe they're worried it's going to die and this is the only way it's going to survive. Now, Di, when did you... I'm a bit confused. You've had a great life. Well, maybe. It sounds like a great
sounds
life.
Good.
I can't believe this. I told you to turn off my the phone. And,
there you've got your phone.
I cannot believe this. This is disgusting. I'm sorry, Henrietta. My apologies, darling. That is totally unprofessional.
Never mind.
Totally.
Carry on.
Now, you've got, thank you, Mum. You've got a number of books there. Are they your poetry?
Yeah, they are.
Do poets make any money?
No.
No. You're telling me the one you've read from the first book you read from, that was launched recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, the end of 2024 at the Brunswick Green.
And I assume,
standing room only in
what?
Brunswick.
Standing room only?
Yeah.
What? Brunswick Green's as big as a telephone booth, is it? An old-fashioned telephone booth? No. So there's lots of people.
Lots of people.
Why would they turn up?
Because... believe it or not, performance poetry, spoken word poetry, is huge in Melbourne.
Huge. I've heard the word poetry slams. Is that why it's huge?
Well,
is that like cage fighting for poets?
Yeah, it is. No, but everything isn't poetry slam. But no, performance poetry is where people get up and speak on an open mic. Quite often, there's a feature reader who is a reader who's got, you know, experience or is well known and highly regarded or whatever. And it's a very democratic form of poetry because it's open to all and everybody has a go and everybody is received warmly and welcomed.
There's no hissing and booing.
There is no hissing and no booing.
Is people looking up at the sky, nothing like that?
No.
Nothing.
People are very polite.
In the poetry world.
They really are.
It's not like the chess world where people are at each other's throats.
No.
It's unbelievable. There you got your peace and joy. Maybe it's about poetry, not about Buddhism.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, you only have so much time for so many things. So I did a lot of Buddhist organising, you know, like bringing Tibetan lamas to Melbourne and running big events in town halls and small halls and everything. And in 2008, I stepped back from Buddhist organising and spent 10 years doing nothing but poetry. And then I got roped back into Buddhist organising again back in 2018. But anyway.
Because you were missed. You were missed. Now, I'm going to ask you a funny question.
All right.
You know, in the music scene, when somebody becomes, you know, well-known and famous, they demand this brand of Scotch whiskey and, you know, whatever before they perform. Now, do Buddhist lamas have this? Do they demand things when you bring them across from overseas?
No, they don't.
They don't?
They genuinely don't. I mean, they want a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or something. I guess the one thing they might really miss is something called butter tea. But nobody makes it in Melbourne.
What's butter tea?
It's tea made with butter.
Not yak milk, just butter.
Well, it's made with tea and hot water and butter.
Why doesn't anybody make it?
Well, I mean, the Tibetans make it, but you know, like if you're an Anglo Aussie, you're not probably going to make butter tea.
Right.
But that would be what they would secretly be. Not right. asking for.
Well, you've got a cafe next door at 3CR. I'm going to ask them to put butter tea on their menu.
I don't think anyone wants it. I mean, I like it. It's a bit like soup.
Soup.
It also has salt.
No sugar.
Soda. No sugar. No sugar. Okay. I don't think people actually generally don't like butter tea, but it's actually a really nice drink.
Is it? All right, maybe you should have a butter tea restaurant and have a llama there. A real llama, not a Dalai Lama. Now, Going back. Now, I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, go on.
As I said, you've had this extraordinary life. How do you make money?
Well, I worked as a university administrator for nearly 30 years. So obviously there wasn't any money to be made as a Tibetologist.
A Tibetologist, I like that. It reminds me, I own you, if I could. I was going to do archaeology, but my parents said, look, just do medicine. Nobody's going to employ you as an archaeologist. So you had the same problem,
yeah.
did you?
Yeah. yeah. But, you know how to run things. So I worked in a number of universities and, you know, just running the back end of everything.
The back end of everything, running yeah. things.
Yeah.
So you're an MC. Or an organiser?
Well, I'm an organiser. Mm. So, you know, I worked at my last role in a university was at Swinburne as a research coordinator in the Centre for Astrophysics and Supercomputing.
Well, that sounds interesting. What were the people like you were organising? Were they hard to organise? They were just too enthralled in their own field of study?
They were all right.
They were all right.
Yeah, they were right. And they used to give these brilliant lectures once a month, which was the funnest part of the organising. So you organise these amazing lectures for the general public and they talk about cluster galaxies and, you know, whatever.
Fascinating things.
Extraordinary things, which I would never have even thought about before.
Do you think over the last few decades we've kind of taken science for granted and just forgotten about it, how important it is?
Well, I don't know about other people. I mean, I think science is really integral to everything, but I understand that there is some kind of reaction to experts and reaction to expertise and science, and I don't understand it.
No, it's just like... like in the medical field, I just don't understand the anti-vax movement.
I think it's crazy.
I mean, you know.
I don't get it at all.
We got no polio. We didn't have any diphtheria.
Yeah.
We had a little bit of whooping cough.
Exactly. And as a child, I experienced whooping cough and measles and mumps and chicken pox and everything, you know. Yeah. And in India, I saw people get polio. Mm. And, you know, I've sat in the room with Tibetans who have tuberculosis. And, you know, I understand these are real, real problems. You know, I've seen people with smallpox scars.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't get that there can be any reaction against vaccinations. I don't understand that.
No. Well, it makes two of us. Obviously, we've got a scientific mind and we're no longer needed in the 21st century. It's all about belief. Is poetry based on belief?
Poetry is based on sharing experience.
Really? So how do you form a poem? Do you think about it or does it just come to you in the middle of the night and you jump up and write it down?
Yes, it's more like that. And, you know, I'll be ruminating about something and then I'll realise I've got some words in a particular phrase and I want to write it down.
Mm-hmm. So do you carry a little book with you or you speak into your phone?
No, I write on the back of supermarket receipts or into my, you know, diary, which is a hard copy thing.
It's like me writing your name down on a piece of paper. You still do it that way.
Yeah.
And when you write the poem, do you do it by hand? You don't go on a computer or a screen?
At the first stage, I write by hand. At the second stage, I'll type it up. Yeah.
And how many poems would you write? And how many would you keep?
So probably most I would share in a spoken word environment, like a reading at a pub, for example.
Pub?
Yeah.
Poets go to pubs.
Poets go to pubs all the time. They're dedicated drinkers, most of them. They're
dedicated drinkers.
They really are.
Yeah, look, I had visions when you first came in and you started speaking of your Indian experiences. We had a guest here many years ago, non-podcasted and before podcasts, and she was in Afghanistan and India in the 1960s, you know, 20 years before
Amazing.
You.
Amazing, yeah.
And I said, well, how'd you make a living? And she said, well, I used to smuggle 4 kilos of cannabis across the border and nobody would check you.
Yeah.
And that's how she made her living. And so it's good to see that you had a rich aunt who died and left you some money and then you became an administrator. So
I mean, you know, there are different paths in life.
Now, one of the – I understand – that first poem was interesting because obviously it was about refugees.
That's right.
And have you had an interest in
– Yeah. Well, I was particularly – perhaps politicised by our offshore detention regime, which I just thought was astonishingly bad. And, you know, when the Tampa happened in 2001, I couldn't believe it when the ALP got on board with John Howard and tried to turn the Tampa back and then set up this facility in Nauru. And then people just, you know, were abandoned there for years. And then, you know, relief when it finished, and then to have it come back under a Labor government and then maintained under the Liberal government that followed Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd was quite shocking to me. And, you know, I believe we should have some kind of charter of rights that applies both onshore and offshore so that, you know, gross human rights violations can't be justified, because, you know, the offshore detention of people on Manus Island and Nauru was astonishingly unjust, unfair and cruel.
And it still continues. People need to
remember. Yeah, that's still, I mean, they've reopened Nauru and there's people there and they've just been abandoned.
Did you have any personal experience as far as the refugees were concerned?
Yes, well, I used to be in contact with the men on Manus Island and talk to them, as there was any number of other people. I've also been a member of the Grandmothers for Refugees and going along to the demonstration on Saturdays in Belgrave for a number of years, though I haven't been going for the last couple of months because I've now got another commitment on Saturdays. But, yeah, and I also organised a petition for the protection of one of the witnesses to the murder of Reza Barati, who was killed on Manus Island in, I think it was 2013, and there were four people who were involved in his death, and two were prosecuted and convicted. One escaped, two were not prosecuted. There was a New Zealand guard and an Australian guard, and they were safely repatriated to Australia without being charged. And then there was these two Papua New Guinean men who were employed as guards, and they were prosecuted and found guilty, and one of them escaped. And, you know, the primary witness was Benham Sattar, and, you know, he was not protected. And I just couldn't believe you could be running a justice system and not protect your witnesses.
I don't know where all this sympathy comes from and empathy. It's not a 2026 thing, you know that.
I don't know.
You don't know. Now, have you got another poem for us?
Yeah, look, I'll find another poem.
And while you're doing that, I'll just remind people that Di Cousins is our guest. She's a permanent fixture on Spoken Word, and we actually haven't spoken about Spoken Word.
Yeah, we haven't.
No, but we will, we will.
We will. So this is a poem I wrote for Julian Assange. Secrets live in coal mines with crushed tunnels, in hidden jails where prisoners have numbers but not names, on unofficial flights trafficking those assigned to torture, in Guantanamo, which is outside all legal jurisdictions, in dubious statements of accounts where line items conceal funds, in rooms without windows with stacked boxes of forgotten papers, in memories and cover-ups, broken childhoods and shame, in whispers and furtive looks and coded conversations, in graveyards where coffins are reused, in intentional forgetting and the lies of politicians. The life of secrets is fed on fear, sustained by shadows, dependent on the dark.
So I've noticed you've got three poetry books. I assume you've got many more.
There's a couple more.
So how do people get access to them? Because they, you know, what I found fascinating is that these are personal and political, intertwined. It's like everything in life, you know. You've got musicians who talk about love and, you know, death and that's it, and themselves, and then you've got musicians who've got a political bent. Is political poetry common in the poetry scene in Melbourne?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
They've been radicalised.
We're all very radical.
You're all very radical. So, look, if somebody's interested, we won't speak about spoken word yet, but if somebody's interested in getting into this is a scene I know nothing about, but if something is interested in being radicalised through the poetry scene, where do they go?
There's a website, I think it's Melbourne Poetry. Just Google Melbourne Poets Union. I used to be the vice president of Melbourne Poets Union.
You've got a union?
Yeah, we've got a union.
But you don't get paid, do you?
No.
I think if you went on strike, would we notice?
No. All right. But anyway, but my books are available from my website, which is dicousens.com, dicousens.com. You know, the poetry scene is out there in Melbourne every other night of the week. There's, you know, always stuff going on. It has its own audience. It's really quite astounding. I haven't been a part of it so much because I've moved further out of town. So going in and out of the city in the middle of the night is harder. But it's a big thing in Melbourne.
Is it a CBD thing, as you're suggesting?
No, it's sort of a Brunswicky thing.
A Brunswicky thing.
Yeah.
Has it filtered across to Northcote and Castlemaine yet?
Oh, yes. Yes. And I've done a feature in Castlemaine.
You've done a feature. Yeah. And how many people turned up?
At least 10.
At least 10. That's better than most of the things I organise, so you've done well. Do they actually feed you?
I think I got a cup of tea or something. But, you know, there's a regular reading at Wood End, for example, called The Chamber Poets.
Yeah, I've involved some radical comedians in the last 12 months or so through Awkward Giraffe, and they do regional gigs and they get about the same number you get. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is you do it and you love it.
Yeah.
So when did you walk into spoken word?
I walked in 2008 to a gig called The Spinning Room, and I'd been along to the Melbourne Poets Union because I'd heard of the Melbourne Poets Union, and I made contact through Facebook with them. And then one of the people who was at that reading said, you know, he ran a gig in Paran, and I went along to the Spinning Room, and that went on for another 5 years or so. And then there was a great gig run by Michael Reynolds called Passionate Tongues, and that only finished last year or the year before. Anyway, actually, my book launch of One Breath was a Passionate Tongues gig at the Brunswick Green. So that was the last night of Passionate Tongues. Anyway.
Excuse me.
Go on.
Your poetry sank Passionate Tongues, did it? You said it was the last night.
The last night, yes. Well, that gig had run for 25 years.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've been doing this program for ages. I know how he must have felt after 25 years.
Well, I didn't run it for 25 years, no. Michael Reynolds ran it, and I've just recruited him to join the Spoken Word team.
But you haven't told me when you started at Spoken Word.
So I started Spoken Word in 2014.
Tell us about Spoken Word. When's it on? How does it work? Who's involved? Because there may be, there always are, aspiring poets out there in the ether. And they may want to contact you.
Yeah, good. Spoken Word is on every Thursday morning from 9 to 9:30. We have a team of four, and we each take care of our particular Thursday morning. So I look after the first Thursday in the month, and somebody else does the second, the third, and the fourth Thursdays in the month. And you can just contact the station, just the generic station email address, and let us know about your work, and we'll get back to you if we have a space. But people have fairly specific interests, but our radiothon show is on the 18th of June.
18th.
And I think we are collecting submissions of recordings of poems, which will be broadcast on the 18th of June.
Right. You mentioned the word radiophone. Radiophone. You're expected to raise money for 3CR. Through poetry.
Yeah, we do.
I thought all poets were poor.
Who knows? I think there's so many poets, you know. Anybody could be a poet.
No, I could never be a poet. Well, Henrietta could. She's talented.
I think Henrietta might be a poet.
Yeah, I couldn't. I couldn't imagine me putting these words together. Couldn't imagine it. Henrietta, are you sure you don't want to put on the microphone? We're luring you to the microphone. You will speak sooner or later. Look at that. Girls versus boys. Oh, girl germs, boy germs. What next? So in store for you in the future? You're not a young chicken anymore.
No, no. Well, I'm doing art. Why not?
Art?
Yeah, art.
What type of art? Visual art?
Oil painting.
Oil painting, not acrylics. Oil, yeah. Not acrylics.
Yeah.
Oil.
I moved to the Dandenong some years ago and I started oil painting with the teacher up on top of Mount Dandenong. And
excuse me, out in the open?
No. I mean, it's a studio.
A studio on top of Mount Dandenong, right. I was out somewhere in the country near Bright and there was this little sign saying there's this gap, you know, and you get this beautiful view. Turn up. It's full of bloody people with their easels, painting.
Oh, gosh.
It's disgusting. And I thought when you said Mount Dandenong, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
There's people on top of Mount Dandenong. No?
No. There may be some people painting outside, I don't know. But anyway, so I moved out there and then I started oil painting.
Definitely oils, not acrylics.
That's right.
What do you like about oil painting?
Well, you can create images that express an idea and, it's a way of sharing something that is attractive and interesting and, different. And I like painting skies and horizons and landscapes and, night skies. And
yeah, you're the type of person that would turn up at this gap and paint and ruin my view.
Yes,
I know you're
that's
your type.
Me.
Yeah. Have you got another poll?
Oh, okay. Let's find another poem.
Yeah. Well, it's extraordinary talent we have here, Di. It's not often we have talent on Radical Australia, but we've had some musicians that are questionable lately, but Henrietta's laughing. No, they were very good. I'm just being facetious. Anybody who comes on Radical Australia is good. And what we like is people who actually do something, not just think about things.
Yes.
You're not a conceptual artist, are you?
No.
Good.
No.
I'm sick of conceptual artists. You know, I can conceive this, conceive that. I remember I first met my first conceptual artist in the late 1970s and he said, I'm an artist. And he said, I'm a conceptual artist. And I said, what's that? And he says, I think about things.
Oh. Well, that's a good thing to do.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't call yourself an artist, would you? Come on.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Now, so what have you got for us?
All sorts of things. So we lost our very good friend Sisto from Pellegrini's a few years ago, and I wrote a poem about him. Pellegrini's. We are still here. We are still here. And Rocco, standing, embraced me, sitting on a bar stool at Pellegrini's. We have lost Sisto. It is nearly 1 year since he was killed by a madman with a knife in Bourke Street, and yet the cafe continues, seemingly unchanged. See the long row of fixed stools placed before a wall-length mirror, the 1950s paraphernalia displayed on the shelves over the work area, the faded ads and pictures, but also a full page appreciation of Sisto from the Lord Mayor 5 years ago. The crowds, the granita and lasagna are the same. And yes, Rocco and I are still here. But what tricks my mind plays. Did I not see Sisto still here behind the counter? No, it was Rocco. And yet, perhaps Sisto is also still here.
So as a Buddhist, do you accept the concept of reincarnation?
Yeah, absolutely I do. Yeah.
That's interesting in that poem.
Oh, well. I mean, people can hang around a little while before they reincarnate.
They can hang around. What?
Yeah.
Causing nuisance, being a nuisance, spilling the coffee. How did you get involved with Pellegrini's? What, you just went there for a coffee every week?
I used to go there because I used to work in the city and I used to go there all the time. Mm. And, I always liked Pellegrini's. It was special, with its character, its kind of vibe.
Are you going to regale us on the 4th of July at the 50th birthday party at Collingwood Town Hall? Do the poets have a table?
Do we have a table? Well, that's a thought. We haven't organised a table yet. Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah, go and see Meg tomorrow.
We'll
give her a
me.
Ring. Go and see the station manager. I reckon considering the standard of that poetry, that you deserve a table. Because obviously we're going to be bored buying crap, you know, during the 50th anniversary. And it would be good to have some poets actually there performing.
Oh, sure.
5 hours, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Well, we can put in our 10 minutes worth.
10 minutes each. No. Seriously, I think it's an art form that people don't take seriously anymore, and it's kind of lost there in the, you know, the jumble of things that people can do, like shout at the net. But this is real. You actually interact with people. You had a real launch. Can't believe it. Not a virtual launch.
No,
of your
we
poetry.
Were all there.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And it was full.
Full.
It was full. I was very impressed.
Is there any jealousy in the scene?
Well, there can be rivalries.
Rivalry, right.
And people can, you know, say the wrong thing and then hold a grudge forever. That happens.
It happens in any human organisation.
Yeah, and it is a disorganisation, not an organisation.
It's not an organisation. Well, it's an organisation of disorganised people.
Yeah, well, anyway, I mean, no, there are organised readings, but, you know, it is a very individual. I mean, you know, there are collectives, but it isn't organised.
Right. In the last few minutes, could you let people know once again how to access your poetry and how to access spoken word here at 3CR?
Yes, well, spoken word at 3CR is on Thursday mornings from 9 to 9:30, and we also have a podcast. And you can find...
Excuse me, you've got a podcast here at 3CR?
Yeah, we have, of our spoken word program.
How long has that been going on for?
Decades.
Decades. A podcast. So if you go to 3cr.org.au and put spoken word, there'll be hundreds of your programs up there.
Hundreds of them.
Unbelievable.
I can't believe it. Hundreds.
Hundreds.
Yeah, hundreds. You can access the scene in Brunswick. Just wander down Sydney Road sometime and...
look for a poet. I could say, tapping people on the shoulder. Excuse me, are you a poet?
There's all kinds of readings. I'm not on top of where they are at the moment,
right.
But you just sort of look up Melbourne Poetry. I think Melbourne Poetry is a website, and yeah. You can find access to my material on diecousins.com. I'm also a wedding and funeral celebrant.
You're a wedding and funeral celebrant. Have you got a specific website for that?
Yeah, that's diecousins.com.
C-O-U-S-E-N-S.
Yeah.
So if people want an unusual wedding... Or unusual funeral, they contact you, do they?
If they want a normal wedding, a normal funeral.
Really? Even a normal one? That's extraordinary. I can't believe this. Now, yeah. I'd like to thank you, Di, for coming on Radical Australia. And this is one of the special programs of part of 3CR Christmas Ornaments, which we have here. I'd like to invite every listener to come to the 3CR 50th anniversary celebrations on the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall, which is where?
The Collingwood Town Hall is on Punt Road.
Yeah, but where? It's actually not in Collingwood. It's in Abbotsford.
Right.
I found that out a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. Can you?
No. Well, no. They keep changing everything.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And Henrietta, thank you for speaking. We thought you were dumb. You couldn't speak. But obviously, Di has brought the best out of you. Obviously, you're a closet poet. And a 60s baby. This she won't even put on the microphone, but
yeah.
She speaks to us.
Yeah, it's great.
I can't believe it. Well, thank you very much. We've got 1 minute to go. And don't forget the 3CR radiophone.
Yes.
We all need to make money to keep 3CR on air, not just spoken words, but Radical Australia. Our radiophone is going to happen next Wednesday. And Henrietta has got some little sound bites. And while I'll ask people to donate money, we need to raise about $1,500, which is not very much. A good bottle of champagne is $1,500 these days.
Well, you know. I think I'm a bit more affordable.
What, spoken word?
No, my champagne doesn't cost that much, no.
Well, it should, considering how good a poet you are. Shortchanging yourself, you know. I mean, I'll buy you a 15...
Well, you don't have to.
Well, I will once I win Powerball one day.
Yeah, good.
I actually get a Powerball ticket when it's over 10 million.
Yeah, good.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.